Don't spend another winter with your home colder than it should be. Hi, I'm Roy Spencer with PermaSeal. We measure the amount of heat loss and recommend solutions to keep it comfortable. Call PermaSeal for your free estimate, 800-421-SEAL, or visit permaseal.net.
WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and spending part of your Saturday with me. I'm honored that you do. My friends, we have so much to talk about today on the show, as ever. Today, we are focusing a lot on the Olympics. There's a lot to talk about with the Olympics, but we're also going to be talking about some stuff going on right here that's really, really fun. Some very, very cool events that are starting up this year in Chicago that I want you to know all about because they're really, really fun. And of course, we're going to be talking about social media as ever. But first, my friends, let us start with the Olympics because there's so much going on there and there's a lot of people talking about a lot of different aspects of the Olympics. But I want to focus a little bit on the endorsements because I think that is a really, really interesting aspect. And there is an issue, there is a piece of that that you may not even realize has changed quite a bit. So joining us now to talk about that is Daniel Roberts. He's a reporter at Yahoo Finance and you can follow him on Twitter. He is at Read Dan Wright on Twitter. Welcome to the program. How are you?
Hey, good. How you doing?
Great. Thanks for joining us today. So this is a really interesting story, and it's all about Rule 40. And about a year ago, Rule 40 kind of got tweaked a little bit by the International Olympic Committee. They changed their ruling on it a little bit. But essentially, it says that during the Olympics that you basically you can't do any endorsements outside of the brands that are attached to the Olympics. But break down the nuances of this for us, because it's a little more complicated than it sounds on the surface.
Yeah, you know, Amy, it's a fascinating rule, and I agree with you. I think it's one that most fans didn't know about until now, but now it's really coming to a head. It's a decades-old rule, and it basically says that the Olympics, and that's the IOC, the International Olympics Committee, and by extension the USOC, can threaten legal action to protect their trademark. Now, what's crazy is the trademark includes words that you might think would be normally generic, words like medal, summer, games, gold. And so the idea is if you're not an official sponsor of the Olympics, and, you know, the official sponsors have paid something like $200 million apiece to be an official sponsor. There are only maybe 15 of them. If you're a brand that isn't an official sponsor, during a blackout period that starts a good 2 weeks before the Olympics and lasts until a week after the end, you can't do anything around the Olympics. You can't explicitly use any of those words on social media. You can't do advertising with an athlete that you sponsor if it's an Olympic athlete. That has always been the case. But in 2012 in London, it really started to bubble up that athletes were getting very frustrated because, you know, they would tweet something like, "Can't wait to swim tonight. It's going to be great. I can't believe I'm at the Olympics. Thanks, Under Armour." Well, Under Armour is not an official sponsor. And so there was a lot of pressure to change the rule. Finally, it's been changed. But what most brands that aren't official sponsors will tell you is the changes are pretty unsatisfying. Now they're allowed to do campaigns using an Olympic athlete, but still they can't overtly refer to the Olympics. They can't say, "Go Michael Phelps tonight at Rio." They can just, you know, do a photo of him that has nothing to do with the Olympics. Now, of course, everyone knows what they're doing.
Right.
So, yeah, it's very controversial.
So if you are a brand, say, you know, a T-shirt company, and all year long you have this athlete that is appearing in your ads, and this athlete is tweeting about your product and things like that, what the rule is essentially that person could not, in the old rule anyway, you just have to stop those ads for the blackout period. But now you can still run them. You just can't tweak them to say, you know, "Good luck at the Olympics" or anything like that.
Well, exactly right. And in fact, it used to be that if you were Under Armour, you couldn't run any ad with Phelps during the Olympics because he's in them. Mm-hmm. Now you can, as long as you don't refer to the Olympics. And the part that's really, I think, getting the most attention is when it comes to the athletes and their own social media accounts, because you saw a lot of them say on the night before the blackout period, and I mean, how often is something like a marketing blackout period so public that even the athletes know when it starts?
Right.
But the night before it started this year, a lot of them were saying, "Well, since the blackout period starts tomorrow, I got to get my thanks in. Thank you, you know, Nissan." Well,
right.
Actually, Nissan's not a good example because I think they are an official sponsor. But, you know, "Thanks, Under Armour. Can't believe I can't thank you starting tomorrow."
Wow.
And it's kind of crazy. I mean, the distinction is very micro. Like, Phelps could put up a photo, and it's him in an Under Armour swimming cap, and it says, "Working really hard in the pool tonight." He couldn't even do that in the past. Now he can. But he still can't say, "Working hard in the pool tonight. I'm ready for Rio. Thanks, Under Armour."
Isn't that interesting? And I think the social media part of this is the most interesting, you know, because it's extending to the athlete's social media, their personal, you know, their personal accounts, and also to brands. So if you are, say, Under Armour, and you are used to tweeting with him all the time, suddenly, even as I understand it, you can't even retweet an Olympic, like an official Olympic tweet.
That's the craziest part, is that you can't retweet the official Olympics account. I mean, I pointed this out earlier this morning, or maybe it was last night, but imagine there must be some intern who works for the Olympics that has to manually look at every Olympics account tweet and look at every account that retweeted it. I mean, this is an account with 3 million followers.
Yeah.
It seems crazy, doesn't it? But we know from people sort of reporting it that they really are policing this. They're sending out letters. If you retweet the account, they're sending out letters to brands like Oisell, O-I-S-E-L-L-E, which is a women's sports apparel brand in Seattle. And their CEO has been very vocal about hating this rule. And in addition, there's sort of a little anti-Rule 40 campaign that has started, and they managed to get the official domain name, rule40.com, which is funny. And the Wall Street Journal, I should give them some credit, they dug into this and found that the people who own the domain name are from Brooks Running, which is a running sneaker brand also in Seattle that is owned by Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. So I think we're seeing even that executives from companies that aren't official sponsors are getting a little bold here, and they're sort of publicly saying, we hate this rule, it's outrageous, it restricts athletes from thanking their sponsors who've done so much for them. Mm-hmm. So it's a fascinating thing. I think it's sort of the biggest business subplot there is at this year's Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, it really is interesting, because I always get the sense athletes are really, it seems like they have really good relationships with their endorsements, you know, with their endorsers, and they, I think a lot of them, especially younger athletes, really understand what they've done for them. I mean, at a time when, you know, when you're just when I think that takes you into a professional category is when you start getting endorsements, and that takes you from when you can quit the day job and just focus on perfecting your sport and doing this thing and training for it. And I think athletes are really, really very grateful for that. And so I think it's frustrating on both sides, is the sense that I get.
It's true. And I mean, of course, if I'm wearing my skeptical reporter's hat, I should note that, you know, they're getting some money from these
sure,
sponsors, so that's
right,
nice.
Right.
But yes, I mean, you're right. It helps you bring your brand broader. It helps you raise your own exposure when you have a big sponsor. And that's true. And I should note that under the new rule, I mentioned that, you can run a campaign now during the Olympics, as long as you don't mention the Olympics, but you had to get it approved back in January. So you're seeing a few ad campaigns that are running now. Those had to get approved in January and start running in March. So, for example, there's this great, I think it's a very good piece of creative advertising with Michael Phelps. It's an Under Armour ad. He's in the pool. He's in the weight room. I don't know if you've seen it. It's a minute long. There's inspiring music. And it's been running since March. And it didn't say Olympics because it can't. But now that it's still on TV, everyone knows it's about the mm-hmm. Olympics. But what a lot of brands are saying is the changes aren't even helpful enough, because we would have had to, you know, start new creative and design a new ad, you know, 5 months before the Olympics.
Right.
So to say that it's changed, well, it still hasn't changed enough. And that campaign against the rule is now really becoming very widespread. So we'll see if there's any impact.
It's really interesting. And I think, too, in the time that we're in, I don't think people have that kind of you know, patience for their media, especially now. We have Snapchat, we have Instagram, you know, just this week rolled out a new tool that's similar to Snapchat, where the content is just instantaneous and disappears quickly. And so I think that, you know, the consumer appetite is for a more immediate, more real-time interaction with brands. So it'll be really interesting to see how this evolves.
Yeah, exactly right. And I had one sports marketing guy say to me, look, if I'm a brand that's not an official sponsor, I'm going to try and slip in wherever I can. I'm going to do some stuff on Snapchat. Maybe you put out a Snapchat story and it says, we sponsor Serena, go Serena at Rio, because in 24 hours, that thing's gone. I mean, what's the Olympics going to do, you know?
Right. What are you going to do? They'd have to screen grab your Snapchat or something. Well,
right.
It's all really interesting. And everybody, go check this out. If you're on Twitter, go check out @Rule40, or go to just rule40.com online and check this out, because it is a really interesting story, and one I think that is really not getting the attention that it deserves. So I thank you so much for bringing attention to this and talking about it with us today. Daniel Roberts, reporter at Yahoo Finance.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Thanks so much. Have a great day. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, more to talk about all about the Olympics and how one company is connected to the Olympics right here in our backyard, here in Chicagoland. More in just a bit on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and spending part of your Saturday with us. We are most grateful to you for that. My friends, it is Olympics fever time, and everybody is talking about the Olympics and tweeting about the Olympics and posting about the Olympics, and there's so many aspects to it. And we were just talking with Daniel Roberts, a reporter at Yahoo Finance, about an endorsement aspect of the Olympics that has changed a little bit. But you know what? Let's bring the Olympics right here to our own backyard, because there is a local company that is doing a really, really interesting thing with the Olympics to support the Olympics this year, and they are right here in Chicagoland. So joining us now is president of that company. Peter Janker is here with us from ISOVAC Products. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. How are you?
Great. Thanks for joining us. Well, so tell us about the products that you make, because it's really very interesting, the products that you create in order to help as kind of a preventative measure in times of crisis.
That would be correct. Our main component, our main technology would be a portable patient isolation unit that we refer to as our capsules. And what this unit does is it allows for medical intervention of a contaminated patient, but also protects first-line defenders and the assets of the first-line defenders during the transport aspects of that situation. So they could get that patient to some quarantine area and perform further medical intervention or whatever might be needed.
Right, without exposing first responders or any other medical personnel. It is a really,
exactly.
It's very, very interesting. And I know that's, such a big point of conversation around Rio right now. And there were even some athletes that declined to attend the Olympics this year out of fear of Zika and after it being declared such a volatile area of contaminants around Zika. And so it is, I think, something on a lot of people's minds. And there have been a few dangerous things that have happened in the world this year. And so I think that's on everybody's mind too, or at least in the back of their mind as we move into this Olympics time. So how did your company first get involved with the IOC that took your products there to Rio?
Actually, that relationship began in 2012. And we deal with the government of Brazil. So it couldn't be used in any event. But with the World Cup and the Olympics coming up, I think it might have pressed the issue a little more.
Sure.
For obtaining our technology.
And so the product, this capsule product that you use, it is, I'm trying to picture it. What is it? What does it even look like? And how are people able to both perform necessary, medical procedures on the patient while also quarantining them?
What it is basically a clear clamshell type plastic unit. We have medical ports at both foot end and head end. We have a air filtration device that provides fresh clean air to the patient while inside of the unit. And we have glove ports on both sides that allow for the medical intervention to take place. You could IV the patient while inside the unit. You could manually intubate that patient, whatever might come up. And they can also preload any of the medical technology that might be needed during the mission of transport.
It is such an interesting idea, and I think one, we think about if one patient, is displaying symptoms of something, then suddenly we think of it suddenly being, out of control. But this is a really interesting way to control a potential contaminants, things like that. How did this product evolve? What was kind of the initial spark of the idea within your company that led to this product?
It basically came out of the U.S. Department of Defense, kind of a wish list, the foresight back in the, I would say, mid-90s, in that there was really nothing available for the American warfighter if, God forbid, there was a chemical or biological weapon used in the battlefield. There were isolation units, but, the size of a small pickup truck. So the idea of a portable patient isolation unit was born then.
It's very interesting. And what other products that is your company working on that are in this realm of working in this area to keep people safe from contaminants?
Well, we do different variants of the patient isolation unit that you see there. We also do one for the deceased. So if there was a contaminated fatality, and you wanted to be able to transport that, or then again protect the first line defenders mm-hmm. in the transport of that, you would be able to do so. And I think I could reference the Ebola situation.
Sure.
And the handling of all of those human remains seemed to be a major problem.
And was that something that your company was involved in also? I know you do primarily, you do work internationally.
Yeah, we're pretty much all over the world with our technology. I would say 90% of our business is overseas. Our technology has been successfully deployed. Trying to think of what else, but I think that pretty much sums it up.
Right, and then what about domestically? Are these products being used as we hear and see in headlines of contaminants that have that are affecting people in areas of this country? Are you using the products here too?
Yes, the products have been purchased. Mayo Clinic would be a customer of ours. Some of the states I can bring, I think Virginia up would be one of the states that has acquired our technology.
It is really, really fascinating. And everybody, where can people go to find out more about your products and read about your company?
You can go to our website, isovacproducts.com, and everything and anything that you need to know would be available on that website.
Excellent. And that's, I'm sorry, I cut you off. Go ahead.
Oh, we try to explain the technology as best as possible without getting too deep into some of the overly technical aspects of it.
Without giving away all the secrets. I hear you.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, everybody, that's spelled ISOVAC, Isovac Products. You can check it out online, isovac.com. It is a really, really interesting effort going on to really keep medical first responders safe as we think about contaminants and pandemics and things like that, as we have talked about that the last couple of years. This is a really, really interesting way to keep people safe. So everybody, check that out. Again, it's ISOVAC, Isovac, and you can check that out. Peter Jenkins, President of Isovac. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and get you to news and all that good stuff and be right back here in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Youth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us this afternoon. I hope, my friends, that you are getting outside and enjoying some of the sunshine, because it is so beautiful outside. I see people walking by the Michigan Avenue studio and they are all smiley and they look so happy enjoying the sun. So I hope you are able to do the same. In any event, I thank you for being with us this afternoon and sharing part of your Saturday with me. I'm most grateful to you for that. My friends, we have a very special guest in studio with us right now. Joining us now is Jessica Ann, local literary figure, and she is bringing a very cool event to Chicago, and I wanted her to come in and talk about it because it's super cool. It has existed, something like it anyway, has existed on the West Coast for a little while, but you know what? We're doing it our way, and we're doing it here in Chicago, and I'm very excited that it's here. So please welcome Jessica Ann to the program to talk about Lit Crawl Chicago, which is coming up very, very soon, but it is a fascinating event, and if you are an avid reader and book lover like I am, you will definitely, definitely want to go to this. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Well, so tell us about this event and how it came to be here in Chicago.
Well, it is a thing in San Francisco, in New York, in Portland, in Austin, and many more, like you said. And then my co-producer, Lindsay, and I just thought, like, that's so weird that it's never been in Chicago.
When so much literary stuff happens here in Chicago,
such
it would only make sense.
Such a vibrant city.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's the Lindsay she's referring to is Lindsay Moscato, who has been on this program, or been on the station anyway. She was on just a couple weeks ago when I did my quarterly book club on my evening show. She was on talking a little bit about this event.
Cool. Yes. So Lindsay and I worked together at the Neo Futurists, and we sort of had an ongoing conversation about, like, so what happens when you leave the Neo Futurists, and like what literary events are beyond the Neo Futurists? And it seems like Neo Futurists grow up and they do this thing called Live Lit. And we have, like, you know, Write Club and Paper Machete and all of that, you know, literature out loud.
And I mean, that's the best part about Chicago to me. I mean, there are so many great parts. I shouldn't say the best. It's one of the best. And that is that every night of the week, literally every night of the week, there is at least one live literary event happening somewhere in the city. Mm-hmm. And there are so many different flavors and types and so many creative things that people have attached to them that I just love. And I love going to them. They're usually free. They're usually in a bar. Mm-hmm. If they're not free, they're only a couple of bucks donation. I mean, they're so great. And it's just a wonderful way to connect to the literary community here. So Lit Crawl kind of pulls a lot of that magic together.
Yes. So we had that same impulse of like, we could go to any of these places all over the city, or maybe on August 18th from 7 to 10:30, we could go see over 50 artists in 5 different venues, all north of Winnemac and south of Berwyn.
So all in Andersonville area, essentially. And these are all, I mean, these are really great, great locations. The Hop Leaf, which hosts a lot of stuff, is involved. Mm-hmm. Women and Children First Bookstore, which is such a wonderful bookstore.
Yeah.
One of my favorites in Chicago. It's really, really great. Cantina 1910. I mean, so many cool venues that are involved in this, that are hosting all of these events. And so how did you start pulling these events together, and when looking at the programming, mm-hmm. what elements were important to you to pull together to represent everything that goes on here, to represent Chicago's literary scene?
Well, since this is the debut, you know, it mostly started with just emailing our friends. And so since we both have performance backgrounds, you'll see a lot of those legendary live lit performers like Ian Belknap and Sam Bailey. But then we also really wanted to embrace the indie lit scene. Like, we really wanted Curbside Splendor, and my favorite reading series is Wit Rabbit. So they're doing something at Cantina 1910. We just really wanted to marry all avenues of literature in Chicago. You know, not just live lit, not just comedy, not just theater, but everyone making words.
Which I really like, because I think that is kind of a secret of both the improv, the stand-up comedy, and the literary worlds of Chicago, is that mm-hmm. there's more crossover than I think any camp is willing to admit.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of crossover.
Yeah.
And I think that's really great. And I really love that you know, all three communities are so supportive and willing to kind of loan out their people to each
yeah.
other. And I think that's really great. And looking at this lineup, it seems like there's a lot of great stuff at Hop Leaf. There's going to be lots of stuff. Curbside Splendor Publishing is going to have a showcase, which is very cool, and looks like there's a lot of great names attached to that.
Mm-hmm.
There's an interesting thing at Women and Children First called That Book Changed My Life, which uh-huh. I think will be really, really interesting. Tell me about that a bit.
You know, that we just emailed Sarah, who, you know, is the star of Women and Children First, and we were just like, what do you want to do? You can do anything you want. That's how this kind of all happened. We just emailed our favorite people and we're like, what do you want to do? And then so she came up with that whole event all by herself, and she just coordinated all these writers, and, you know, she emailed them and said, would you like to talk about the book that changed your life, that changed everything? And they're going to be there. Megan Steelstra.
Who is an excellent,
yes.
excellent writer and performer
name.
and storyteller here in Chicago, who's connected to Second Story
mm-hmm.
and does lots of great things, and has been on the station before, I think, many times. Pernisha Jones is part of that, another
mm-hmm.
great, great voice in the literary world here in Chicago. And then, too, I'm just looking through this list. There's so many cool things. Where can people go to just get a list of all the things that are happening? How can they find out about all this?
You should check out our Facebook page, Lit Crawl Chicago, and just click on the event, and the entire schedule is right there.
Excellent. Everybody, please go do that. Go to Facebook. Go find Lit Crawl. If you follow me on Twitter, or if you're connected to me on Facebook, I will share this link so you can access it, because I do not want anybody to miss this, because I'm so excited about this, because it's just so many people that have been on this station, so many people that have done cool things out in the literary community of Chicago, that it's just really, really fun. And I really, really love the diversity of the lineup, and also the types of medium all coming together. I think
yes.
that's just really cool that you have an event from, you know, hosted by Andrew Huff, formerly mm-hmm. of Gaper's Block, and then you have all these storytellers, but then you have comedy people, several of whom I've had on this program talking about storefront theater in Chicago. Mm-hmm. So very, very exciting.
We have drag queens reading bedtime stories.
Well, see, like I said, people, there's everything at this event. There's absolutely everything, including drag queens reading bedtime stories. So there's a little bit of everything for everyone. And so essentially people will arrive in Andersonville and just kind of, it's just like a bar crawl and just mm-hmm. kind of hop around mm-hmm. and go to all these events. Is it possible to go to all of them?
It is not possible. That's the thing.
You have to make hard choices.
Yes. You have to choose to see something you've always wanted to see and you've never seen, or you have to see your favorite person. But yeah, so you have to choose. And then, but afterwards, there's a party at Cantina 1910, just for us till midnight. And so we can all meet up there, and there's customary literary cocktails that we can all enjoy together and mingle and muse until the world changes and we're all friends.
I love that. And best of all, you guys, these events are free.
It's all free.
The whole thing is free.
Completely free.
And so it is free. It is open to anyone and everyone, 21 and up, mostly. Not all are 21 and up, but most of them mm-hmm. are 21 and up, because some of them are in bars, indeed. So that's something to note of. And really an exciting event, and I'm so excited that it's happening here, because I've been aware of the ones in other cities uh-huh. for a while and know some of the people that were involved in some of them, creating them in other cities. So I'm very, very excited to see that it's happening in Chicago. And mm-hmm. I'm so grateful to you and to Lindsay Moscato for bringing it here.
Yes, thank you.
Very, very cool. Everybody, again, I'm going to share the links to this, but essentially go to Facebook, look up Lit Crawl Chicago. You will find all the information that you need. And of course, I will share these links so you can find them through me on Twitter and Facebook. Thank you so much for being here with us today, Jessica Ann.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, more of this fun here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, thanks for being with us today on the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Amy Guth, and thrilled to share part of Saturday with you. Thank you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. You know, we've been talking a lot about the Olympics during the show today, and what is really interesting, looking at the numbers, we were just checking this out on the break, Comcast and NBC expect a major, major ad revenue from the Rio Games this year, and they have already drawn, are you ready for this, more than 1.2 billion, with a B as in Bob, 1.2 billion in ad sales. And of course, that is still coming in because we're just getting started here with the Olympics. And I think that's so interesting given the fact that, you know, traditional TV viewing is going down because we have like on demand and we have Amazon and Hulu and all those things. And so we don't watch a lot of TV in real time anymore. Although I think live events are the thing that does it. I mean, I was talking about with this very topic about a year ago with somebody who, and I said, we were just saying it takes something really big for us to like tune in right then when the network says. And the two that stick out to me are when Nick Wallenda walked across the Grand Canyon, because I watched that live because I wanted to see what was happening. And then when Felix Baumgartner jumped from, you know, outer space and hurled towards the earth, and that was on YouTube.
Yeah, or when Nick Wallenda walked across the river right around the corner from here.
I was standing underneath him with camera equipment.
Really?
For any outcome. I was steeled for whatever outcome. I mean, he knows what he's doing. So I
yeah, but anything. But, I remember right. I walked by like an hour before it started because I was working the Hawks game here.
Yeah.
Which was going on at the same time.
That's right.
And I thought, I wish I could stay and watch. And then I was like, if he falls.
I know, because there's, you know, I mean, we say he knows what he's doing, but also he can't control the wind. Like, things happen.
But you're right. But that's the essence of the spectacle and what, yeah, like one of the only things that will draw you to a live broadcast right. anymore. I mean, I know a lot of people who say if there was a way to watch sports on my computer, I'd be so done with cable. Cause
right. That's what keeps you going on.
That's the only thing that keeps a lot of people in, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think what's interesting, too, about the Olympics this year, I was thinking about this the other day, because Rio is only like 2 hours ahead of Chicago time, it's not the significant time difference that it was when they were in London in 2012. Because in 2012, people were losing their minds on social media because news outlets were reporting in real time, because that's what news outlets do. And people were losing their minds over spoilers because people were recording the Olympics, because they were obviously, while most of us were sleeping, they were happening. So people were like, well, no, I TiVo'd that because it was 2012 and we were TiVoing. It was like, I TiVo'd that and I'm going to watch it when I get home from work tonight. Now I know, you know, so-and-so wins. I don't need to watch it. So there was a really interesting debate raging on during the last Olympics about spoilers.
Yeah.
I think spoilers are out of control, personally.
Well, it's age old. I go back and forth on it all the time. I will never hold any ground because when things are spoiled for me, I hate it. But
I don't hate it.
You don't care.
It doesn't spoil it to me because I know how it ends, that's not that big a deal. Like, that doesn't ruin my day. I'm still going to enjoy watching the movie or watching the Olympic event or whatever.
Yeah, but it will be a just fundamentally different experience. But
Nobody died. Yeah. It's okay.
I'm mostly with you. I remember when the Olympics were happening, I did not care. But with certain shows, I'll care sometimes. I don't know.
Like what? What show would you care?
Well, maybe there's none on right now. When Mad Men was going on, that was my favorite show, and I didn't want to know what was going to happen.
I got Mad Men spoilers all the time, and honestly, I didn't remember them. And when I did remember them, I couldn't figure out how in the world we'd get to that point. You know, like halfway through the show, I'm like, how's it going to be that Peggy does what?
I would never come out and say it ruins the show or anything like that. Mostly, I feel like if you didn't watch it when it came on, that's on you. And the Olympics, last time did present, what do you want me to do? Wake up at 3 a.m.?
But it made an interesting
is what I do. I just flip-flop on it, and it's very frustrating.
But it made an interesting conversation where I think we have to draw a line between news and entertainment. And there is entertainment news, but this is sports news.
Right.
And for a news organization to not report it in real time, I think is not responsible reporting on behalf of that news organization.
Yeah.
But at the time, I was with the Chicago Tribune and watching thousands of people call Tribune every name in the book for just saying, so-and-so has won a gold medal in the following sport. People were losing their minds.
Well, they told us in the newsroom here to say, okay, spoiler alert, before we did the scores.
That's interesting.
Results, yeah. We had a line we were supposed to say. I don't remember what it was.
You could start saying spoiler alert before every news story.
Before everything. Right, because it's a slippery slope, I think.
Yeah. You guys don't tell me how Planet of the Apes ends.
Okay? Well, I think it's a slippery slope if you start saying it, because by that rationale, you could say everything during business hours should have a spoiler alert in the event it ruins my day.
Well, don't tell me.
News.
I hate it when they tell me the weather before I go outside. I want to be surprised. Okay, say spoiler alert. 73 degrees.
Skilling would punch you right now. Skilling wouldn't punch anybody.
I don't want to know.
He would chuckle.
He would chuckle. He would not punch anybody. But no. I think the spoiler alert thing has gotten out of control a little bit, and I think we need to keep it in check.
Well, luckily, we don't have to deal with it, as you said, this Olympics, for the most part.
Yeah, not really.
Not really.
I could see people being maybe on the West Coast or Hawaii getting a little bit out of shape because it's an hour ahead of New York. So the only people that are going to benefit is that one little part of Maine that's in that one time zone.
I just loved reading some of the numbers in this story.
I know.
Comcast and NBC. This was 5 years ago when they were trying to buy the rights for the upcoming Olympics that are now going on. Comcast and NBC shocked the television and sports world by outbidding their closest competitors, Fox Sports, by nearly $1 billion.
Offering, I can't even comprehend that.
$4.4 billion for four Olympics ending in 2020. And then they followed that with a second deal to secure the rights for the six Olympics through 2032 at a cost of $7.75 billion. All told, from the New York Times I'm reading, Comcast has paid about $12 billion for the rights to the Olympics, nearly 25% of what they paid for NBC itself. Isn't that
astronomical?
Crazy? It's wild.
That's completely wild. And it's not, I mean, they could still lose on that, right? I mean, I think.
But you said, they've already made $1 billion on this one or something like that? And I think it's a good investment.
Absolutely.
For sure.
I don't think they're going to be in the red, but but I could see it not being. I mean, there's always scandal attached to every Olympics, and it depends on what that scandal is. Sometimes it turns into a very big news story. Like in Atlanta, we saw that suddenly it was about an act of terror. You know, very quickly it became that. Sometimes it shifts. I think right now the sub stories are about fear and about concerns of health, pandemic, things like that. So I don't know. It's interesting to me, especially given how many athletes did not go based on Zika fears.
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely would have gone. Would you have gone?
Yeah. I would have. I suppose I can't. It's hard for me to imagine what it's like to be any kind of athlete, let right. alone an Olympic champion or whatever.
Right. And I can't tell anybody what's the right decision for them. Like, I'm just in charge of me.
I have a hard time with that. It blows my mind that some people would pass it up. Because I feel like
what I love about watching the Olympics is the same thing I love about watching the NFL draft. You see somebody's long dream happen right then. Like in a split second, you see a dream come true for somebody, which is so awesome, right? For NFL, you see someone who's been in a college athlete and done all this stuff and has dreamed of going pro. And in a minute, their name is announced and they do. And then the same with the Olympics. Like here's someone who probably from a young age trained and put in a lot of hours and made a lot of sacrifices, and suddenly they've just done the thing they've dreamed about for years. And I think that's so beautiful. I admit I cry so much during the Olympics because I'm so excited to see that for people, and I think it's really cool. So I don't even like, of course I want USA to bring home lots of medals, but I also just kind of like am happy for whoever does, because you can just see it on their face. They're so excited. So anyway, that's my like mushy smooshy kind of Olympic spiel right there. We'll get back to business next week. Good times, my friends. All right, that about does it for us here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Let's take a little break, get you the news, and then I'll turn you over to King John here in just a bit on 720 WGN.